This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We know a lot more about the human heart than we did in the days when humans believed the heart to be the center of love and emotion. We certainly know more about the heart than we did in 1893 when Dr. Daniel Williams would embark on a surgery that many believed to be immoral. He performed heart surgery. I'll leave it to our guest to tell the rest of that story. Despite all we've learned in the 100 years plus since that fateful day in Chicago, there are still things we don't know. For instance, why are you more likely to have a heart attack if you have gingivitis? Why are other primates, like chimpanzees, seemingly immune from heart disease and vascular disease that affects us? Why do most other animals only get a billion heartbeats in a lifetime, while we humans get 2.5 billion. Those and many other mysteries and secrets are explored in the book, The Man Who Touched His Own Heart, True Tales of Science, Surgery, and Mystery by Rob Dunn. Dr. Dunn is a professor of ecology and evolution in the Department of Biological Sciences at North Carolina State University, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks so much, Mike. It's great to be back.
Great. So, before we talk about anything else or about you, how did it work out for that doctor in Chicago in 1893 who was essentially the first person to do any kind of surgery on the heart, right?
Oh, it's an amazing story. So, he's an African-American doctor in Chicago in the 1890s, and he had a private practice, but then his friends came to him and said that their daughters, who were African-American, couldn't find any place where they could be trained as nurses. What could Williams do about it? And so Williams decided to set up a hospital where African-American nurses could be trained and that would cater to the entire community. And so he set this hospital up in an old house, and things went pretty well. And then in 1893, the World Fair was in town, and it was one of the hottest summers in history in Chicago, and all sorts of crazy things were happening. And one of those things was that in a bar, James Cornish was listening to music and stood up and all of a sudden realized he'd been stabbed. And he was rushed to Williams' hospital, Provident Hospital, where he was put in a gurney and attended to. And it became clear pretty immediately that he'd been stabbed right over his heart. And so the challenge in that moment was that in 1893, not only was there no treatment for any problem of the heart, it was viewed as terribly taboo to even imagine a surgery on the heart. And so the standard medical text not only said don't do surgery on the heart, it said no one will ever do so, that we've reached the limit of what is possible. And so here's Cornish in the hospital, and all that Williams can do is to look at him and hope that he gets better. And this is what's happened to everyone who's been stabbed in the heart for thousands of years at this point, you know, whether it was an Aztec or, you know, somebody living in Egypt or anywhere else. And so Williams is confronted with this moment. And in this moment, everybody else who's ever been confronted with it has just decided to let the patient sit and see if they heal. Mm-hmm. And for whatever mix of hubris and compassion and whatever else, Williams decided that he would operate. And so they gathered around in this tiny room in the hot, hot summer.
It was over 100. Williams, it was over 100 degrees, wasn't it?
It was over 100. In this room, it would have been even hotter.
Yeah.
And so the nurses and Williams, they're dripping sweat on the patient. There's not great anesthetic. There are no antibiotics. And they start to cut into his chest. And, you know, it's just, imagine this scene, this incredible hot scene, and it's this first moment when anybody's ever done this, to cut into the chest and to go to the heart to see what can be done. And I think in retrospect, I mean, the most obvious scenario was some sort of cataclysmic failure, just a real disaster. But Williams gets the chest open and sees the heart. And when he does, he can see that the pericardium, the sac around the heart, has been cut by the knife, but the heart itself has not been. And so, you know, trying to time his stitches to the beating of the heart, because the heart's still beating, there's no way to do anything else. He sews the pericardium shut without antibiotic, sews the body back shut, and then they just watch Cornish to see what happens. And amazingly, he lives long enough to go home, to live a good life, and then to get stabbed again, and Williams treated him again. But it's this incredible moment, because until then, you know, nobody'd ever dared to do it.
Well, it's 1893, and you write that any doctor who dared operate on the heart would be shunned, and many thought should be shunned. And in that same year, 1893, a prominent Austrian surgeon commented that the surgeon who should attempt to suture a wound of the heart would lose the respect of his colleagues. So, obviously, he knew all of this. Was he shunned? What happened to Dr. Williams?
He wasn't. You know, he faced some challenges professionally later, but for the most part, what it did was to begin to usher in heart surgery. But it was a tentative ushering, in as much as even though there was then the realization that you could operate on the heart, that this could be done, that nobody could really do anything yet aside from stitch shut stabbing wounds, which turned out at the time to really be a pretty common injury to the heart. And so people, you know, quite a few people were saved by this next step. But it was a pretty modest next step.
This longstanding societal and medical taboo against doing anything to the heart, how much do you think – because human beings have been looking at the heart, thinking about the heart for thousands of years, never operating on it. Do you think this held back research on the heart?
Longer than for sure.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Mike. So I think an interesting comparison is the brain. And so the first surgeries in the brain, which were very simple, they were drilling a hole in the head into the brain and removing tissue. Those were done 6,500 years ago. And so we have skulls from that time that have healed. And so successful brain surgeries, whether they accomplished anything or not, happened really early. And so it's not just the case that surgery took a while to advance. The heart was different. And I think that difference did prevent us from understanding the heart. And so did
the heart was different because of our viewpoint of what the heart did or what it meant to be a human being with a heart. Why was it different?
I think it's a mix. I mean, so on the one hand, it's for a long time been this spiritual part of the body. I mean, across many different cultures, the soul lived in the heart. There was a time in the Dark Ages when it was imagined that God actually lived in the heart, literally, and would scribble notes, you know, on the inside of the heart about whether you've been good or bad. And you can imagine you're sinning and you think, oh, this is going to be a long note. But that was literally believed to be true. And so the heart is just embodied much more than the other organs have.
So when did we start to understand that the job of the heart is simply to pump oxygenated blood to muscles and organs and oxygen-depleted blood back to the lungs? When did we understand that?
Well, very late if you use the word oxygen. So it would not be until the 1600s that we understood that the blood pushed stuff out to the body, that necessary stuff returned and then was pumped to the lungs to get other stuff. The oxygen was what was being gathered would be even later. And so really it wasn't until the 1800s that we understood the heart in any sense of the way that we now understand it. And even then, I mean, there were still huge mysteries and there's still huge mysteries today. And what's really interesting about how late we understood the heart is that because the heart is so central in what it's doing, you know, as it pushes oxygen out to the body, that's what allows the rest of the body to be alive. As it gathers, you know, waste from the body, that's what allows those cells to exist and not die in their own cellular excrement. None of the other organs make much sense until you understand the heart.
Yeah, because the heart is not just pumping blood and moving oxygen around. It's moving a lot of stuff around.
Yeah, it's everything. It's you know, it's like trying to understand a city without knowing about what the roads do. And we didn't. And, you know, it's pumping blood oxygen. It's pumping immune cells. It's pumping, you know, all the sugars that each cell in your body requires. The heart is what makes it possible to have a body. It's what makes it makes us different in so many ways from a single, you know, from a bacteria cell. It holds us together.
Since one in three adults will die of a cardiovascular disease, and because you mentioned that heart diseases are so common that it was almost inevitable that someone you knew well would suffer from a problem heart while you were writing the book, and it in fact turned out to be your mother. Did you intend for this book to be a kind of wake-up call about heart, how we treat our heart, how we treat our bodies, or simply as a way for us to know more about what scientists know about the heart?
So I intended the book – I mean, so I started writing this book while writing about other parts of the body, and about the appendix and about the weird organs that we have in our armpits and about how much mystery there still is and how we work. And so for me, the heart was this amazing organ that on the one hand is so central, and on the other hand, it still holds many mysteries. I mean, we still really don't understand many features of it. And so it was then a great context in which to explore the history of our understanding of the body in general, and also to look forward to what we might know in the future and what we still don't know and why we're missing some of these discoveries. But then it's also this organ that we know fails. And so it's also a great context in which to think about the limits of our bodies and the limits of medicine and what it means to be mortal and human. And
You're an evolutionary biologist by trade, and the last time you were on this program, we talked about your book called The Wildlife of Our Bodies, and it was all about the microscopic creatures that live on, in, and around us. And it was fairly creepy, actually. But you're not a medical doctor. You're not a heart surgeon. You're an evolutionary biologist. So what is it about the heart that interested you from that point of view?
Well, so I think we've been really good at understanding the heart as a pump, as a mechanical device. But I think as one looks at the story of the heart, that it's really an evolutionary story, and the limits of the heart have to do with its evolution. And even the treatments for the heart have to do with our broader context relative to the rest of nature. And so, you know, on the one hand, you have this narrative of the heart where in a herky-jerky way, starting in 200 AD, give or take, we start to understand the heart. And eventually we, you know, Williams does the first surgery and then we move forward from there. But really, there's very little attention to its context. How did the heart come to be the way it is? Why does it break so often? Are our hearts different from those of other primates? Mm-hmm. And then even simple things like where do the drugs we use for the heart come from and why? That's my terrain.
Yeah, you wrote about how most of what we know about the heart really is recent, really recent. I mean, really recent. 1953 is when we seem to be – we get on the bicycle and it starts to roll forward. But now we've kind of lost interest in the heart. It's just kind of there. We don't talk about it much. Doctors don't pay much attention to it evidently. But given that the body can live as long as the heart is beating – but you're officially brain dead if the heart has stopped beating for 3 minutes. Why aren't we furiously pursuing heart research? It's the center of everything.
Yeah, we're furiously pursuing one kind of heart research, which is straight ahead technical advances and, you know, how to put new stents in or how to do more nuanced changes of what we already do. What we're not pursuing is the context. Oh, please.
Go ahead. Finish your sentence.
Oh, in part it's because the number of people working on the context is teeny. And so we've left all of the context of our heart to dozens of people.
Okay.
Rather than tens of thousands.
We'll stop there. We'll come back with more with Dr. Rob Dunn, author of The Man Who Touched His Own Heart. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Queen's University of Charlotte. The Queen's Learning Society presents best-selling author Michael Lewis on February 26th. Tickets at queens.edu. Perception is often. Perception is actually most times our reality. But the trouble is, your perception could be wrong. A new Discovery Place exhibit makes that crystal clear. Nothing is as it seems in Illusion, which uses optical, audio, and other tricks to fool you, to fool your eyes, to fool your senses. We'll hear more about how they accomplished that in the first part of the program tomorrow. And then we find out about how some of our cultural institutions, including Discovery Place, are engaging young professionals, the next generation. That's tomorrow at 9. We'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, nearly 75% of people in U.S. jails are there for nonviolent offenses. Many are too poor or mentally ill to get themselves out. New calls for reform for our local criminal justice system.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and as we head toward Valentine's Day, and we know that the heart is the center of all love and emotion, we're talking about the heart. No, that's not what we're doing. We're talking about the real purpose of the heart with Dr. Rob Dunn. He's an associate professor of ecology and evolutionary biology in the Department of Biological Sciences at NC State University. He's also the author of The Man Who Touched His Own Heart. We'll talk about him, that man, in a second. You used the term, our heart breaks, in the last segment. Our heart breaks a lot. It breaks, you say, more often than any other part of our bodies. What do you mean by break?
Well, the most common way that our heart breaks is that we have these coronary arteries that actually feed the heart. They're these special arteries that provide oxygen to the heart, and they clog. And when they clog, our heart starves, and it's the most common cause of heart attacks in humans. And it happens to a large proportion of us. And what's fascinating about it is that we've thought it to be a normal consequence of our modern lifestyles for decades. But until very recently, nobody had ever actually checked to see if other primates have the same problem. And so our hearts break.
Do they?
And as it turns out, they don't. So chimpanzees in 2011, their hearts were finally compared in a detailed way to those of humans. And chimps have heart attacks. There's a sad picture on the web of a chimpanzee that's had a heart attack that's being wheeled off, and her friends look on. And it looks very much like a human story. It looks like, this is an animal that shares most of its genes with us. It's dying the way we die. What could be more similar? But nobody ever checked whether it really was the same kind of heart attack. And as it turns out, chimps do have heart attacks, but they're of a totally different kind, which is amazing because it presents two mysteries. And the one mystery is what's causing the heart attacks that chimps have. And nobody knows. There are these weird syndromes where the muscles develop a fibrosis, and so the muscles sort of go crisscross against each other and contraction can't happen. So we don't know what causes that. But then there's the other mystery of why we have the kind of heart attack we have, and how old that is and where it comes from and why it happens to us but not them. And 2011 is the first time we thought to ask that question.
Have we looked at the hearts of other non-primate mammals and seen what kind of disease those hearts, if any, are susceptible to?
Yeah, to a very limited extent. We know what happens to the hearts of rats and mice in the labs. But the broad context of what heart disease looks like across mammals or across birds is missing. There's actually a great story about a woman named Helen Taussig, who's best known for doing some of the very first work in treating congenital heart problems in children, that when she retired, she decided she wanted to understand the ways in which hearts of different animals fail. And so from the retirement home, she found a spot at the Delaware Natural History Museum, and so she would drive from her retirement home to the museum to dissect bird hearts to try to get a sense of this bigger picture. And so she dissected thousands of bird hearts trying to get the answer.
Your book is called The Man Who Touched His Own Heart, and you tell that man's story, and like the patient in the first heart surgery in 1893, it too begins in a bar. Stay out of bars is the moral of this story, I think. But this time it was a German doctor who thought it might be possible to send a catheter into the heart. What year was that?
Yeah, so this starts in the late 1920s and sort of progresses into the early 1930s, and so it's very, very recent. And when this starts, there's actually no way to see a problem in the heart of a living patient. You can listen to the heart, and there is an art to hearing what the heart is saying. But there was no way to look inside. And so this fellow, Werner Forsman, he'd looked at many cadavers, and he could see in the cadavers' hearts many of the ways that the hearts were failing. And he thought, well, if I can figure out how to see the heart of a living person, maybe someday we could figure out a way to intervene and deal, for example, with the clogging of the arteries and other problems. And he read about a study in which a catheter had been fed into the heart of a horse through one of the horse's veins. And he had this idea at the bar that maybe he could do this with a human. And so he told his friends. His friends told him to go back to drinking. And then the next day, he goes in to tell his boss at a small German hospital, look, I have an idea. I want to send a catheter through the vein of a patient into their heart, because someday this might be useful. And his boss, you know, said, well, I know your mom, Werner, and if you do this, she'll be sad and you'll disappoint her. You can't do this. It's crazy. And he says, well, I'll do it on myself. And his boss says, no, that's worse. You can't do that. How about you try it on rabbits? And so he goes home and he thinks about it, and days and weeks pass, and he starts to talk to a nurse. And through what must have been incredible powers of persuasion, he convinces the nurse to allow him to do this on her. I mean, I can't even convince my students to stay a little bit late at work. I don't know how you convince somebody to let themselves be catheterized with a procedure. No one knows whether or not it's deadly, but he does. And so they go into the hospital, and he straps her down and tells her to get ready. And then he turns around and he grabs a urinary catheter, which is the only thing he has available.
And that's much bigger than a catheter that would go into your heart, correct?
Yeah, it's much bigger than what we'd use today. And so he makes an incision in his own arm and starts to feed it up his own vein, because he the entire time had intended to do this on himself. He was never going to do it on the nurse. And so she looked
on. Why then involve the nurse? Why have her strapped on a table?
Yeah, so he was actually so low on the totem pole in the hospital that he didn't have a key to the cabinet where the catheters were kept, and so he needed her. And she would also come to be necessary later in the story, because he gets this up his arm and all the way to what he thinks is his heart, but he can't be sure because they've chosen a room to do this in that doesn't have X-ray equipment. Mm-hmm. And so he has to unstrap Gilda, the nurse, and they then have to walk two flights of stairs down.
With the catheter still in his arm?
With the catheter. And at this point, he really has no idea how dangerous this is. It's not been done. I think he has a sense of how dangerous he thinks it might be. But really, you know, what happens if you have a catheter bobbing in your heart and you walk down a hallway? It was very possible at that point that that would just be a totally deadly endeavor, that as they stepped out into the hallway, that would be it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't it. And so they made it down the hallway. They made it slowly down the stairs. They get to the first floor, and they start to go into the room where the X-ray machine is. And there is one of Werner Forsman's friends who tells him that he can't do this. You've got to stop, and tries to pull the catheter out, which is probably the most dangerous moment in this whole story. And somehow Werner pushes past him, gets to the X-ray machine. They take the X-ray, and they can see that it's almost all the way to his heart. And so he stops. He squinches himself up. He pushes it a little bit further up and takes another X-ray. And sure enough, there he has it, a catheter in his own heart. And so at this point, his boss gets involved, his boss who told him not to do it. And at first, the boss is mad. And after a few moments, the boss sees that a major step has been taken in medicine. And so there's a moment of celebration. And they go out to dinner. And Forsman envisions a future. I made that sound romantic, but it was just celebratory. It is Valentine's Day. They go out to dinner. And Forsman imagines the many next steps he can take. He imagines using this approach to figure out what's wrong with hearts of living patients. He imagines even the possibility that perhaps you could treat the heart in some way using a technique like this. Mm-hmm. And so the future to him seems very, very bright at that moment.
But not so, because this is an amazing accomplishment that not only went unrewarded. If I read your book correctly, he was punished. He couldn't get a job for a while, could he?
Yeah. So, I mean, he initially gets a job, and then as he lands that first job that may allow him to follow up on his work, his paper comes out and gets press around the world. And when it does, his boss, who frowns upon publicity associated with medicine and science, fires him. Mm-hmm. And so he'll struggle over the next years to get jobs. And eventually he's able to get a job in urology and doing some surgery, and he moves up the ranks doing that. But it's not a job that gives him the space to do experiments, to do research. And so although he does a few more bits and pieces, for the most part, that's it for him with this work. And so for all he knew, that was also it for the approach. But unbeknownst to him, two Americans at Columbia University had started to follow up on his work and started to move forward with some of the ideas that he originally had. They had them independently after seeing his initial approach. Mm-hmm. But it was starting to lead toward the entire field of cardiology, toward all of the interventions we now think of that you can do in the heart without busting open a chest.
And ultimately, didn't he won a Nobel Prize for this?
Yeah, but not until after. So World War II starts. Forsman works as a medical officer during the war, comes back from the war as a prisoner of war, has trouble getting a job again, finally gets a job in a small town in the Black Forest, and then gets a phone call, that sort of a series of phone calls that he doesn't want to take. And it's at this time that he hears that the Americans have won the Nobel Prize. And he describes that moment as feeling like he planted an orchard and somebody else is eating the fruits. But soon thereafter, he realized that he, in fact, had also won the prize. And so it was this incredible moment of vindication for what had been a mad and heroic and consequential self-experiment.
Now, he had had a lot of experiences in that hospital around corpses. And he, I guess, in the course of autopsies, he found a lot of problems with people's hearts and with their heart valves. And he discovered what we now call plaque that had built up on these corpses' artery walls. And you say he began to think that some of the problems of the bodies were simply due to bad plumbing that might be fixed, which is why he went to this catheter experiment that he conducted on himself. Was he the first person to view the cardiovascular system that way, as something that's simply plumbing that could be fixed, like Roto-Rooter?
Well, so I think there's a long history of viewing the cardiovascular system as plumbing. He was one of the first to imagine this Roto-Rooter style fixing. In terms of the seeing the atherosclerosis, there's actually some much earlier precedent, which is that in the 1400s, Leonardo da Vinci dissected many bodies in order, in part, to do great art. But then as he was doing art, he also became sort of obsessed with the body and understanding the body. And this is sort of at the end of the Dark Ages, the beginning of the Renaissance. And so there was very, very little knowledge about how the body worked, less than there'd been 1,400 years prior. And so Da Vinci was essentially – he needed to explore the body anew, as though almost nothing was known. And so he was just very careful at looking at what he saw. And so he did many dissections of the body. And one of the things he found was that he was looking at the valves of the heart. And one of the valves of the heart has these three pieces that close shut after the blood goes out to the body. And Da Vinci wanted to figure out how it closes shut. And so he did these amazing models of the heart valve, these glass models through which he would let little seeds go. And what he thought was that maybe the blood moved through that valve and it formed eddies on the other side, and that those eddies closed the heart valve. And it would turn out that he was right, although nobody would realize it and nobody would rediscover his insight until 1969, which was the first time that was seen again. But he also one day was talking to an old man, a very, very old man, and they were having a great conversation, and the old man suddenly died. Mm-hmm. And Da Vinci thought, oh, what a great opportunity for a dissection. And so – he decided he was going to dissect this old man, and he was going to dissect him for a specific reason, which was that almost all of the dissections he did were of young people who had died of terrible, terrible diseases. And so he knew what that looked like. But here was an old man that had died of something sweet. He had died a pleasant death. And so Da Vinci wanted to know what causes a pleasant death in old age. And he had no idea what it might be. And so he, you know, took this guy down to a dark room and with a candle over the next week would proceed to dissect him as completely as anybody had ever dissected any body, looking for this thing. And Da Vinci was actually in doing this, the first one to see atherosclerosis. And he thought, he saw the narrowing of the arteries. He saw that they became like old rivers, twisty. And he imagined that narrowing prevented nutrition from getting to the body. He didn't know about oxygen. He didn't know really how the heart worked. But he had this insight that was really fundamentally right.
Wow. And we've been studying the heart. As you said, it dates back before Leonardo da Vinci, thousands of years before him, despite the taboos. You write about this man named, I guess it's Galen, who essentially was the physician to the Roman gladiators. I didn't know they had a physician. I think they cared about them. The Romans would not allow autopsies because they were not sure what organs would be needed in the afterlife. But Galen was trying to sew up gladiators who'd been cut open in the arena. So I know he drew a lot of pictures of what he saw inside various gladiators' bodies, but did he do anything significant with the heart?
Yeah, so Galen's a really amazing character. One of my favorite stories about him is one of the days when he was being tested to get that job as the doctor to the gladiators, and he brought with him what he called an ape, but it was probably a Barbary macaque. And he's standing around with the other doctors-to-be, and he guts the macaque. And he says to the other doctors, if anybody else can sew this macaque back up, you can have the job. And Galen got the job. And what's not clear is if he got the job because he could sew the macaque up, or because if you go to an interview and you gut a macaque, that's such a crazy thing that everybody else just goes away. But he did, and so he gets the job, and he was, at least by his own account, he was the best doctor to the gladiators ever. He was not necessarily a humble guy,
yeah.
But in the gladiators' wounds, he could see into bodies in ways that others hadn't or couldn't, and he started to try to understand what was going on, and so he built on others, but he had great insights, and so. He actually thought that what was going on with the heart was that a bunch of blood was being produced in the liver, that was then going to the heart, that the heart was then pushing some of it through the lungs, and the lungs were giving it some vital stuff, what that might be, he didn't know, and then it was going out to the body. And our tendency in looking at Galen's model of how the heart works is to think that he's kind of dopey, that, you know, how could you ever think that? But the truth is, you know, given the observations he had, you know, given what he knew, his insights were remarkably foreshadowing of what we would later understand. And I actually think he might have been able to understand it all given a little bit more time.
Dr. Rob Dunn, author of The Man Who Touched His Own Heart, True Tales of Science, Surgery, and Mystery. We'll be back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and call experts, a call center and answering service now in Charlotte. More than 30 years of 24/7 call handling, accountability, text messages, and confirmation. Details at callexperts.com. Nearly 75% of people in the U.S. jails are there for nonviolent offenses. Many are too poor or mentally ill to get themselves out. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, a look at new calls for reform of our local criminal justice systems. And if you'd like to join our conversation about the heart, ka-thump, ka-thump, now's the time. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. You only have a couple of billion heartbeats left, so do it now.
This week, Morning Edition brought you stories from the series Living Cancer.
It's not just one number that you can give to a patient. You can't say to a patient, you've got 12 months left to live, like in the movies.
Every day you hear reporting that goes beyond the day's news. Tune in to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for Morning Edition weekday mornings from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Rob Dunn, Associate Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at NC State University and the author of The Man Who Touched His Own Heart, also the author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies, which is all about the things that live on us, in us, around us, that are some of them, many of them are beneficial to us. We couldn't live without them. But we're talking about the heart today, and we've been talking about the past leading, how we learned in the past about what we know about the heart. Let's move toward the 21st and the 20th centuries. And one of the things that you're working on in your lab has to do with heartbeats. You say that every species can be measured by its heartbeat. Would it be accurate to say that each species seems to have a certain number of heartbeats assigned to it for life? In other words, we have X number of heartbeats, humans, chimps, turtles. That's all they got. And when they're out of it, they're out of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, so I think the way to think about it is that every time the heart beats, it wears your body down a little bit. And so the more beats you get, the progressively more that your body wears down, the less able it becomes to generate an immune response to a pathogen or prevent cancers from developing. And as a result, if you look across mammal species at least, the average mammal species gets a billion heartbeats if it's lucky. You know, if you're a squirrel and you get eaten by a cat, well, that can happen on beat two. But the maximum life expectancy of different mammals is pretty consistent. And that's interesting from a bunch of different reasons. And one of them is that if you look at humans, we've broken out of that rule, that historically we would have gotten about a billion beats. And now if you live in a developed country with good medical care, you might get 2.5 billion, which is to say we're all getting an extra life relative to, say, a shrew or a whale, both of which get about a billion.
Extra life and a half.
Extra life and a half, yeah.
And that's because of nutrition and modern science and sanitation? Is that what it's because of?
Public health is a big part. So antibiotics, the ability – vaccination, antibiotics, medical care, some of the heart care, all of those things add up to those years. And we can see that if we look globally, that there are still many countries that don't – where the average person doesn't get those beats. You know, there are countries in Africa where the average person is still getting a billion beats because of the lack of sufficient public health, because of the lack of sufficient medical care, which is to say for those of us who are lucky enough to get an extra life and a half, we should use them wisely, whatever that means.
Well, you know, each species seems to have a different heart rate. In other words, their heart beats X number of times a minute, and it's not the same as what our heart beats are like. Does an understanding of beats per minute, therefore beats per lifetime, hold the clue in some way to longevity?
I think it does, to aspects of longevity. And so to give some examples of the extremes, so some shrews have almost 1,000 heartbeats per minute. And so, I mean, so I can't even do that. I can't speak that fast. Mm. It's just incredibly fast rate. And so they use up their lives really quickly. You know, they're young poets of the animal world. And then some whales get 10 heartbeats per minute resting. And so it's this incredible range of how fast we live our lives.
Do we understand why such a small creature, a shrew, would need to have its heart beating 1,000 times a minute at rest?
In part, it's because its body, the surface area of its body is great relative to its size. And so in order to keep itself warm, in order to metabolize, it needs to be doing much more work per unit time. You can be small and have a slightly slower heart rate, but basically the smaller you get, the more it's got to speed up. The bigger you get, the more it slows down. But one of the interesting things is not just that heart rate and longevity, but it's the things that if you look at the relationship between heart rate and longevity, the things that seem to get too many heartbeats. And so those animals are then really interesting because we can look to them to understand how it is that they are getting more heartbeats. And so ground squirrels, for example, seem to get more heartbeats than they should. Possums get far fewer than they should. And what's going on in their bodies that that leads them to have longer or shorter lives, and what can we learn from that?
Mm-hmm. Talk about woodchucks.
Yes.
Do they hold the clue? Do they hold the clue to longevity?
I prefer to call them whistle pigs, but so woodchucks are fascinating. So there was a guy, Bigelow, who was working in the 1940s, and he wanted to figure out a way to slow down the heart, in part so that he could do surgery on the heart. And he thought that woodchucks held the secret to this. And if you look at woodchucks, they actually get more years out of their chubby little bodies than you would expect given the resting heart rate. And what Bigelow figured out is that the way that they're doing that is through hibernation. When they hibernate, their heart slows down, and so it buys them some extra years. And so he became convinced that if he could figure out how the woodchuck was slowing its heart down, he could use that in surgery, and he could maybe use it in other ways to prolong human life. And so he set up the biggest woodchuck-raising facility in the history of man. It's probably the only woodchuck-raising facility. He had hundreds of woodchucks. He had many, many grad students go through his lab whose job was to take care of the woodchucks. And he wanted to figure out what was going on. And so he studied them in every conceivable way to figure out what was happening in their bodies when they went into hibernation, what compounds were released, what could be done to slow the heart. And finally, one day in the lab, he and his group found what he thought was the magical compound. And he tested it, and sure enough, in humans, it seemed to slow the heart down. And he called it Hibernin because he thought it was just this magical sleepy time molecule that could turn any of us into Rip Van Winkle. And, you know, maybe when he got older, he would give it to himself and live slowly a bunch more years until new innovations came. And they tested it a couple more times. And then they even went on to patent it. They were so sure they'd found it. And after they patented it, somebody else noticed an unusual aspect of this compound, which was that it was the same compound in many plastics, which is when Bigelow realized that they'd not found a magical woodchuck compound, but instead they'd just found something from the plastic tubing, an alcohol from the tubing they were using in their experiments that sure enough would slow the heart down a little bit, but not necessarily in a very good way.
Hmm.
And so he abandoned his woodchuck work. He thought that was it. You know, he was never going to figure it out. There's no record of whether he just freed all the woodchucks and they slowly ambled out of the experiment or what happened. And that was it. And he died. And then unbeknownst to him, another group working on ground squirrels, which are actually related to woodchucks, started to work on the same question. And that group at the University of Alaska Fairbanks has actually been able to discover the compound that ground squirrels and maybe woodchucks are using to slow their hearts down. And that compound is actually now being used clinically to slow hearts in hospitals. And so it's this amazing example of the ways in which looking to the differences among mammals and how their hearts work can inform how we think about and treat our own hearts.
Yeah. And if a shrew, as you, I think a shrew, you said his heart beats 1,000 times a minute. And they never live even a decade. They don't even live 10 years, and yet their heart beats 1,000 times a minute. The blue whale may live 100 years, 10 decades, with a heart that beats 6 to 10 times per minute, and yet both species have hearts that beat a billion times in their lifetimes. So where does that put us on the longevity spectrum when our hearts beat 2.5 billion times in a lifetime?
Puts us way above the graph. We're by far and away the luckiest mammal in that regard. You know, and it's to say nothing of the quality of those beats. Maybe a shrew's heart beats. I mean, a shrew's life is just so good, you know, that those beats are worth two. I don't know. But in terms of the number of beats, we're unique. There's nothing else like us. We've put ourselves in this situation unlike anything that's ever happened in the history of mammals.
Hmm.
And I should say, though, that the caveat is that all of the studies to date comparing mammals in this regard have looked at 10 or 20 or maybe 30, even though there are more than 5,000 mammal species and there are millions of species more generally. And so one of the things we're now doing in the lab is to go back to the literature to try to compile from old papers and new papers in all different fields all of the records of the resting heart rates of different animals to try to figure out what these relationships look like for birds, which no one's ever looked at this in birds, what they look like for reptiles, amphibians, fish, to see what the big picture looks like. And so if the listeners want to help with this project, they can actually go to beats.robardunn.com and find this project and help out by helping us to look through old studies to find these records.
So it's Beats by Rob – Beats – say it again. The website?
Beats.robardunn.com.
Okay, Rob R. Dunn, and Dunn is D-U-N-N. Research. We've talked a lot about Leonardo da Vinci and Galen and doctors in 1893 when they didn't really know very much about the heart. Research really seemed to take off in earnest in 1953 when the first heart-lung machine was put into use. Then angiograms came along, followed in 1967 by both the first bypass operation and the first heart transplant. All of that happened before, I think you said it was 1998 or 88, when it was finally confirmed that Leonardo da Vinci's predictions about how blood flows through the heart valve was actually correct. How much more is there to learn about a heart? It's a pump. How much more is there to learn?
I think there's more to learn than we so far know, that there's more yet to know than what is known. And so if you imagine a glass, the glass of our knowledge is less than half full still. I mean, the truth is the heart's not a simple pump, that it's dynamic, that it responds to, you know, it does respond to our emotions. You know, when you feel sad or lusty or whatever else, your heart rate changes. It responds to fear. Our arteries actually have the ability to respond to their conditions. And we're just beginning to understand these things. We still don't know why our hearts are different from those of chimpanzees. We don't even know what lives in the heart. And this harkens back to the last book. But there's not a comprehensive study of the life forms found in your heart right now, Mike. I mean, who knows what you've got in there? You know, you probably don't have a scribbling God, but you may have quite a few bacteria. We just don't know. And so if you're 18 years old and thinking, well, I want to study a last frontier, the good news is that the heart and every other organ in our body remains a last frontier, our moment in time is far more humble than we imagine.
In fact, you write about that in your book. I'm trying to find the page. 322, you say, studying the ecology and evolution of hearts around the world, it's kind of a call to science. You say, this course of action is not likely to make you rich or famous, but it may well lead to a moment somewhere in a small lab, or better yet, in the middle of a jungle, in which you suddenly realize something about the heart that no one in the history of science or society had even considered. That thrill will be worth it, worth pursuing this career, worth some sacrifice. That thrill will give you goosebumps that never quite go away. You're speaking here, I got to say, it has to be from personal experience.
Yeah, that thrill of knowing in the lab that you're on to something that no one else has noticed before about the living world. I mean, that's an incredible thrill. And it's a thrill in any context, but to be able to figure out something new about our bodies, these bodies we live in every day and depend on. Oh, I mean, what could be greater than that?
Hmm. Here's a very good question from Barbara in Matthews. If women have a higher average heart rate than men and mammals have roughly the same amount of heartbeats in a lifetime, why do women live longer than men?
Yeah, so the relationship between heart rate and longevity does not hold as well within species, although there is a modest relationship in humans between heart rate and longevity. The effect of whether you're a woman or a man is bigger. The better predictor of longevity in humans is actually how fast your heart goes from sort of the fast heart rate during exercise to a resting heart rate. And that does vary with gender as well. But that prediction of longevity is more among species than within.
Well, one of the big stories about the history of the heart is that the thread that connects this unfolding line of human knowledge about the heart was kept alive by Muslim scholars. Why Muslim scholars?
Well, so when the Western Roman Empire fell, the thread of knowledge that had been continuous going back to ancient Egypt broke in the Western Roman Empire. And so if you're talking about what's going on in Italy, less was actually known in 1400 than was known in 200 about the body, about most things in science. Those were the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. And it was not just that individuals lost that knowledge, but the books stopped being copied. They stopped being translated. And there were very few places where they continued to be translated. And one of those, you know, cultural contexts was in the Eastern Roman Empire, but particularly among Muslim scholars who copied these ancient texts. And in doing so, I mean, that's what holds us to the knowledge of the past, is that work. And one of the amazing moments in that context, it happens in Toledo in Spain, when Muslim scholars who've been translating and copying the ancient works come together with Jewish and Christian scholars. And there's this great moment when they're all translating back and forth, this peaceful time when knowledge is passed among cultures. And much of what we know about the past comes from those individuals, these amazing individuals who valued knowledge when all was dark.
Dr. Rob Dunn is the author of The Man Who Touched His Own Heart, True Tales of Science, Surgery, and Mystery. We've just scratched the surface. And if you'd like to be part of this Beats project, he mentioned the website. We'll put that on our the website, beats.robdunn.com. We put that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks if you'd like to look into that. Dr. Dunn, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Mike. Great pleasure. Have a great morning.
You too.